Welcome to the Aspen UK podcast, where we bring people together to discuss topics that matter.
Welcome to the Aspen UK webinar, Scaling Up Innovative Solutions, the first discussion in our new Critical Climate Conversation series with Mars Wrigley UK, bringing together pioneers from different technologies looking to build our net zero and no carbon future. We are delighted you're able to join us. At Aspen UK, we bring together experts to explore some of our most pressing challenges, and today's event will do just that. Off the back of the relatively recent advances in solar and wind energy, the panel will be considering, can other promising innovations have the same success? How can we apply the lessons learned from the success of solar and wind to other innovations? And what solutions should we be betting on? I'm Ollie Chapman, Director of Seminars here at the Aspen Institute in the UK, and we really enjoy using the Aspen Institute's global convening power to invite thoughtful and experienced individuals to discuss some of the most challenging topics of our time. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator for today, Kate Turner. Kate is the founder and CEO of Vor, a startup strategy firm providing carbon accounting and offset strategy services. Kate served for 8 years in the Royal Air Force as an engineering officer, but decided to divert her attention and passion towards climate and biodiversity challenges. Kate is also a really engaged member of the Aspen UK community, having attended one of our executive leadership seminars, and is an Aspen UK Rising Leader Fellow, so is the perfect person to be leading today's conversation. Over to you, Kate.
Thank you, Ollie. I'm thrilled to be here moderating with Aspen UK. Thank you very much for having me. And with that, I'd like to introduce our panel. We have Stephen Lewer, the CEO at Unitrove Group, a company working to deliver zero emission hydrogen fuels. We have Natasha Patel, the director at Baringa Partners, where she supports energy, automotive and financial services clients, develop their EV strategies, transition their fleets and deploy funds into the sector. We have Gaurav Sant, an endowed professor at UCLA and director of UCLA's Institute for Carbon Management. He's founded and launched several carbon capture technology startups. And we have Beena Sharma. Beena is the CEO of CCU International, focused on deploying and scaling carbon capture utilization technology. So a huge welcome to our panel. We're so, so glad to have you. With that, I'm going to jump straight into some questions, and I'm going to direct this one at Stephen. So what's been your experience scaling up hydrogen fuels? Can you take us on the journey that you've traveled from conception to sort of production there?
That's great. So my journey actually through hydrogen has been quite an interesting one, because hydrogen technologies is actually something that we've only very recently kind of been involved in, actually as recent as around 2020 or so. But my journey actually started a lot earlier than that. So Unitrove, our organization, we actually founded ourselves back in 2008. And back then, we were involved in sort of doing a lot of design and consultancy for those people that were focusing on low carbon solutions. And I guess through that kind of progress and as things have kind of changed, then the kind of solutions have kind of evolved from going from low carbon solutions to sort of zero carbon solutions. And I think part of the journey for hydrogen has been this idea that, you know, with the times kind of changing and with kind of social movements starting to push this narrative for net zero by 2050, things have started to accelerate, and therefore it's driving some of these kind of more interesting technologies. And with that said, actually, hydrogen's been around for quite a long time. So it's not a case that this is kind of new technology. This is something that's sort of been historically used before, but now it's finding a new context for it.
Let's go over to Gaurav. Same sort of question to you. So what's been your experience scaling up carbon capture technology startup, or working with carbon capture technology? Kind of take us on the journey that you've been through in that sector.
Yeah, thanks for asking, Kate. Very nice to be here, and thanks everyone for listening in. I think from our perspective, as we've thought about it, really, I run a translation institute, and what we seek to do is take things from the bench scale to commercial or pre-commercial prototypes. The reason for this is really simple. So, you know, I think it's fair to say that there's no shortage of ideas around carbon management. I think the question to really answer is around which of these will work at scale. And so what we seek to do is to really try and de-risk ideas quickly. So how do you take things from the bench scale to a commercial or pre-commercial prototype and show that it actually has viability in the real world? I think this has really been a key question to answer, because what we often end up with is like I often call them, is often technologies where they seem really promising, but they don't actually pan out. And in the context of what Stephen just said, if you have 30 years to act, 30 years seems like a really long time, but it isn't when you consider single industrial plant buildouts at commercial scale take 4 to 5 years. And so, you know, as you think about sort of need of the hour, the size and the dimension of the problem, I think we need to sort of take measured shots on goal. We need to be really focused. I think focus is super important here. You know, we need to be thinking about green electricity, which is something I'll come back to later in the conversation. And the last piece really is, I think while it's 100% true that we need to cultivate a portfolio of solutions, we need focus in developing that portfolio, given the fact that we have finite time and finite resources to deploy.
Yeah, I like that. Particularly, I can resonate with the iterating from whiteboard to pilot quickly to fail fast and fail forward in a lot of these technologies. So I like that. And Bina, I'm going to ask you to come in on this. You've got plenty of experience with carbon capture utilization technology. So same sort of question to you. And any thoughts building on Gaurav there?
Yeah, I mean, both Stephen and Gaurav made some really, really valid points. I think they all apply to us as well. With regards to our experiences, what we found is obviously what has driven it is really the market need for this. And the speed at which we're going has to align with those market needs. We are under a lot of scrutiny to reach net zero. And every day we're being told that we're not doing this fast enough. So just in line with that, we have to move just as quick, if not faster, to keep up with the need. There is also a real strong desire to look at costings for this. There is only a certain speed at which we can go at when we're looking at things like government funding, et cetera. So we need to look at alternatives to see, well, how can this be funded? Because there is an immense amount of funding that needs to go in. As Gaurav mentioned, there's lots of ideas, but where do you get, you know, how do you take those ideas forward? And even when you're going forward, how do you then scale them up? And that requires a hell of a lot of funding. So the question a lot of the time is, where does that funding come from? And we're looking at designing systems that are less about just removing emissions and costing, but also maybe looking at ways in which we can create revenue streams for businesses. And it's very similar to, it's what we do in our business. We look at taking sort of carbon capture and creating a different model to create revenue streams. Therefore, the barriers that originally existed for companies, i.e. carbon capture technologies being too large or too expensive and being a cost exercise, you know, you capture at cost, you compress at cost, you transport at cost, and then you inject at cost. So the idea is that we need to find ways to make it viable for businesses. And actually, if we can create revenue streams for businesses to be able to take these technologies forward, then we will be able to scale them up at speed. So I would say certainly for us, the scaling up experience has been really, it's about the funding behind it, the support behind it, but also the drivers for businesses to actually get this done, as opposed to looking at, you know, it's, do we go for the carrot or do we go for the stick, or is it a bit of both?
Thank you. Natasha, I'm going to push this next question I've got over to you. And it sort of builds on what Bina's just been saying about you know, the revenue streams. With your experience of deploying funds into this sector, what do you think we've done well as a global society when it comes to funding carbon capture technologies?
On carbon capture technologies, I have not that much experience in terms of funding, but I do have experience around funding the transition for decarbonization of transport. And so I think in that sector, we've obviously seen that, you know, it has been, just touching on what Bina was saying right there at the end, carrot and stick, and that's really what's helped move the sector along. So the stick has come in the way of sort of carbon emission mandates and making sure that automotive manufacturers have essentially carbon emissions per kilometer that they need to be able to achieve as a fleet in order to not incur fines. And that has, after a while, basically gone as low as it possibly could with a combustion engine. And then they have seen that actually in about, you know, whatever, 7 to 8 years, we are not going to be able to get any lower than this threshold of carbon emissions per kilometer unless we change our drivetrain. And they've seen that transition start to come to fruition in terms of technology and progress about 5-6 years ago. It takes about 8 years to produce a vehicle. And so very much early on with that trajectory, they knew they're going to have to invest into electrified drivetrains if they have to meet those emission targets. Plus there's combustion engine bans announced in various countries around the world, multiple geographies. And a combination of those two things, I think, kickstarted the sector, I would say almost 5 years ago, in terms of the amount of emissions that people, the amount of investment that automotive manufacturers were committing to those drivetrains, to manufacturing those drivetrains. And I think currently we're at something like $300 billion has either already been invested or committed to be invested by those automotive manufacturers to produce those vehicles. Until you don't have the vehicles, the sector doesn't, you know, you can't adopt it. And if you can't adopt it, the sector doesn't transition. So that's been the biggest starting point for the funding. For better or for worse, it's been that stick. And then the carrot has come for the end users in terms of tax incentives. And then those tax incentives have resulted in people wanting to adopt those vehicles. And that's kind of what started us. I mean, we're still at a very early part of the market. In the UK, we're still talking about only 3% of the vehicles being electric and only about 10% or so of sales being electric. But we're still, I would say, you know, again, relative to some of the other sectors, we've made some really good progress. And it has been fundamentally some of that carrot and stick type approach.
Yeah, I like that. Stephen, I saw you nodding a couple of times there. I'm going to push the same question over to you. What have we done well as a global society when it comes to hydrogen fuels?
So I think in terms of society as a whole, I think one of the really interesting things at the moment is this kind of movement towards sort of the importance of climate change. I mean, if I think back a decade or two ago, it was always on the agenda, but it was never really kind of driven in any particular way. And I think more recently, as kind of people and society have been more vocal about the need for decarbonisation, suddenly it's starting to kind of push that narrative and change that narrative right at the top, where now governments are starting to kind of have to listen to the societies that are sort of demanding these kind of changes. And now it's kind of quite interesting that this dynamic is where governments are looking and trying to almost lead in a way, but through some sort of way of trying to demonstrate to other countries that they, for example, may have better technology than another country. So there's always going to be a bit of politics in play. But what's interesting is how the social movement has kind of driven that. And I think hydrogen is one of these kind of areas where there's some very, very promising aspects of where hydrogen could be used. Some people say that it could be a great solution for transport. Some say it could be for heating. Some say it's about storage or transport. There's a whole host of different sort of aspects where hydrogen could play a very, very interesting role. And I'm not here to say that, you know, hydrogen is going to dominate everything and this is the be all and end all for the technology, because I think that there are other equally, you know, fantastic solutions, if not better solutions sometimes as well. But I think just having that kind of social consideration to kind of widening these kind of potential opportunities for hydrogen will allow kind of technologies to kind of be pushed forwards. But I think one of the really interesting things about society is that, you know, quite often we think that we're waiting for a technological revolution, you know, that somehow technology is going to kind of develop and sort of save us or whatever it is. And we're kind of relying on sort of new innovations that kind of come out from nowhere. But actually, the technology has often always been there. One of the classic examples I'd like to explain about is, for example, electric cars. It's only been in the recent sort of a decade or so where they've now started to come to prominence. But we've had electricity for many centuries. So, you know, we could have had these electric cars a very, very long time ago, but because of the social movements and certain technologies gaining some sort of element of dominance, that's the reason why we've ended up with our diesel cars. And it's not to say that it was because we had the lack of technology. Another example of this, for example, is the use of ammonia on vessels. So again, this is a piece of technology that's been used for a very long time. And actually, there was a big movement to actually push it off the ships because it's relatively toxic. And it was typically used for refrigeration cycles and things like that. So, you know, we had that technology and it was starting to be in the decline as we tried to move this off for safety reasons. But now we're starting to have to reconsider them because the agenda has changed, because society is now pushing towards cleaner options, zero carbon options. And now there's a rethought process in terms of maybe we can bring the ammonia back on these kind of vessels again. So I think society plays quite an important role in sort of shaping what the expectations are in terms of where we want to go as a society.
We're going to come back and revisit that idea in a minute. But before we do, I'm just going to flip the coin over. As opposed to what we've done well as a global society, I'm going to ask, what have we done badly as a global society? I'm going to push this over to Bina next. What have we done badly in terms of the decarbonisation journey, just as a whole?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things that we have done well, but there's also some things that we could do better. I tend not to use the word badly because it's negative, but in terms of what we've done not so well, I think the educational piece has been key. And as a nation, as the world, we've not really done that job very well. And what we find is that we push through quite often with policies, et cetera, things are pushed through without the understanding of what markets are doing, what industry is doing, and what works for industry. So certainly the educational piece isn't there. That detailed educational piece as to why and how is not there. And quite often we see things that come out, certainly in policy, that we don't fully understand, and industry will be in uproar because it doesn't work for other areas of the business. So I don't think we do that very well. And certainly with our business, we spend a lot of our time educating people on these technologies and what they can do for their business. The other thing that we really do not do well in is that we tend to think, well, if it's not broke, then let's not fix it. So if I take, for example, carbon capture specifically, if we look at the technologies that we currently use in carbon capture, we're talking sort of 70 years now we've been using amines as a chemical, and it's a hazardous substance. It's not very kind to the environment. For the last 25 odd years, we've been using it for carbon capture. And it works. It has all sorts of problems, but it works. It's very energy intensive. It's very expensive. The amines degenerate, so they need replacing. So it's OPEX heavy. But we tend to kind of go, oh, well, we've been doing that and it works, so let's just keep doing it the same way. Rather than say there must be ways of doing this that is more efficient, there must be ways of doing that doesn't harm the environment or doesn't harm people if it comes into contact with humans. So these are the kind of things that I think we don't do very well. And until somebody else kind of moves into the space, and then it's like, oh, we need to catch up because somebody else is doing this. So that gap tends to widen the more and more we think, well, we're okay here because we're doing okay and it works. So that, I would say, for me, definitely, that's the one thing we don't do well. And also with regards to, certainly from an entrepreneurship perspective, I think the ecosystem typically hasn't been a very supportive, I should say. In some areas it is, in other industries it's not. So we're supportive of, you know, brilliant, you've got ideas. A lot of early stage businesses might get support. But then when you hit that kind of, okay, we're ready to move into commercialization, that's where a lot of the funding lacks. And particularly from an investment perspective, what we're finding is that they will say, well, if you just get one more pilot that does it a little bit bigger, and then get one more pilot that does it that little bit bigger. And then when you get to the stage where they say, well, this is a really good space for us to be in, but we don't understand the technology, so we're not going to lead on the investment, for example. If you get somebody else to be a lead, then they can do all the due diligence and we'll tag on the end there. So that, I think, there is a huge need for these technologies. Is there an understanding? No. Do we need more investment at that crucial commercialization stage? Yes, we do.
To your first point there about education being so, so, so important, I'm going to direct my next question at Gaurav about what's the critical lesson that we all need to learn as a global society as a result of, you know, in this decarbonisation journey, and from the lessons we've learned over the last decade or so as we've been on this journey?
You know, so those that's a great question. Okay, so I think there's sort of two themes that I would like to highlight. I think the first part is perfection is the enemy of the good. I think this is something that we tend to forget all the time. We're a little too focused on perfection, and I think in the quest of perfection, we tend towards inaction rather than action. I think this is a conditioning we really need to build into our collective psyche. I think this is number one. I think the second thing is, you know, I think there needs to be careful messaging, right? So there was some talk initially about that Natasha brought up about incentives and how incentives are messaged to society is also really important. So if you think about incentives at a high level, right? So we can call them as an example, we can call them a tax credit. The question is who pays for a tax credit? It's actually the taxpayer that pays for a tax credit. Very often when we think about things like this, in effect, what we're doing is we're disguising a green premium that's associated with new technology. An important thing for us to really describe is that this is not really a green premium. It's actually a technology development premium. Because what ends up happening is, you know, there are two parts to this. So one is sort of economies of scale. And as you gain economies of scale, things get cheaper. But fundamentally, one of the biggest things that actually happens is as we learn by doing, in fact, technology gets better. It becomes more efficient. And in fact, that's what drives down costs just as much as economies of scale. And so we need to be really careful about sort of messaging incentives and tax credits, so call them what you will, in a manner that, you know, the taxpaying base is not really opposed to the idea of them. I think this is really important, you know, when you think about decarbonization and carbon management in general, because to say that we're going to impoverish the world in the quest of carbon management is obviously a non-starter. And this is one of the reasons why we often see societal pushback against doing things that, you know, in the limit would make sense. There's also a need to be able to message that, you know, there is value recovery associated with this. And the reason that this messaging is important is in many ways, climate change is a deferred problem. It's not something you feel today, you feel 30 years from now, and you feel it differently depending upon where in the socioeconomic spectrum you lie. And so to be able to message this in a nuanced manner, I think really matters. And so when we think about education, it's not really about technology. It's actually a much more encompassing argument that's really about building collective awareness about value creation.
That leads me quite nicely onto one of the questions that I've written for this, which was, I'm going to direct it at Stephen first, but we're going to go around to everybody. Stephen, what's your take on individual responsibility for decarbonisation versus governmental and policy responsibility for the green transition and decarbonisation as a whole? Where does it sit?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So I personally feel that that there are a lot of agendas at play that push the responsibility to the individual to have to take responsibility for things. You know, we're always being told, what kind of car are you driving? Are you driving a petrol car? Oh, you're not doing good for the environment. Are you using those plastic bags? Oh, you know, you shouldn't be doing these kind of things. And to an extent, you know, I agree that obviously if individuals took their own responsibility collectively, that it would all add up. But I feel in some ways that sometimes it's all about the kind of the bigger organizations trying to push the agendas downstream, so it's not their problem. You know, let's take an example. For example, I don't know, the fashion industry, fast fashion. You know, the big companies will say, well, at the end of the day, it's just the end consumers that are wanting these products at really low costs and things like that. We're just serving the market as what they want it to you know, what they want. But I think that's that kind of like not actually taking responsibility at that sort of organizational level, I think, is where the real issues lie. And of course, you know, these are the organizations that have significant power, you know, clearly in size and in terms of wealth and so forth. I mean, here's another example. You know, if I talk about, you know, cars and things like that, we all are asked, oh, you know, we should be doing our bit to drive in a, you know, not drive at all, for example, not fly and take our holidays. And yet, you know, on the other end of the coin, we've got big companies out there that are moving big, massive ships that are, you know, using the worst possible fuels imaginable. So I personally feel that the responsibility has to be taken, not just with the organizations, because there will also be some that will also try to lead the movements as well, but at that government level, because clearly, once legislation starts coming through and they say, look, you're not allowed to do this. I mean, we saw it again with the plastic bags. They when the government said, right, we're going to enforce that, we're going to put some taxes or whatever, or enforce people that they're not allowed to get plastic bags for free. Then that changed a lot of things very, very quickly, you know, and individuals didn't necessarily have to take that responsibility in their own hands. So I do feel that it needs to be driven from the top rather than necessarily from the bottom.
Thank you. Natasha, do you like to jump in? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So I completely agree with everything Stephen said. And it was a really interesting point from Gaurav as well around policies. You can see it actually in the electricity sector, right? So when offshore wind was deployed, the cost of that offshore wind and making sure that that was sustainable was put in as green subsidies into our electricity bills. And then those electricity bills are therefore now misaligned with gas bills. And we can't actually electrify heating because of this additional green subsidy that exists in our electricity bills. So I think it's a really interesting point around policy and how the eventual sort of incentives elements of it actually falls on the taxpayer itself. And we've absolutely seen that in the electricity sector, and we need to find a way of making that, you know, understanding the unintended consequences of doing so and making sure that we really look at, you know, where is policy and legislation truly driving. And I think as Stephen says, completely agreed, you know, the stick approach for better or for worse always seems to work really well because it makes the organizations do something slightly different. And that kind of results in an overarching change that is a lot more. And I think when it comes to sort of, you know, societal change, I think it's fundamentally down to the fact that we're a capitalist society. And in some ways, whenever I think about this, I always feel like climate change is almost at odds with capitalism in so many ways, right? Because we've not put a price on it. We've not put a price on what is this costing our future generations. And until we do that, we're not going to find a way of really making this click. And there's lots of different ways that people have sort of debated how do you put a price on some of this stuff. And carbon pricing is one of the things that keeps coming up. But fundamentally, until you find a way of really equating those two, in a capitalist society, you will be coming back over and over again to government, you know, making that really intervention point and trying to make the change for good, while at the same time balancing all the economic interests of large industries. And it's a really difficult balance, but we need to price in the impact of what we're doing today to what it's going to result in the future. And apologies for the sun. I can't seem to get any sort of way of a decent video on this, but hopefully it's not too bad.
I totally agree. Invite Bina to come in on that too.
Yeah, I think everyone's made some really valid points. One of the things that I find that works for everything, whether it's you know, education or policies, is collaboration. And it's something we talk a lot about, but we do very little of. So I hear it across industries. And, you know, if we look at the energy industry, if we look at the oil and gas industry, for example, they will claim that, you know, the responsibility is on them. It's always being pushed onto them. So I think everyone feels that responsibilities are being pushed around. And certainly when you look at taxes and stuff for the energy, for the oil and gas industry, you see that. But realistically, you know, it is those industries that are really going to drive these technologies forward. It does depend very much on who is lobbying government and who has the loudest voice at the time. And again, without getting too political here, you know, we talk about things like carbon capture, utilization and storage. And really the drive has been towards the storage element, because this is what has been lobbied by a lot of the energy companies. You know, if we can store the CO2 underground, then we can justify more production. Realistically, we need energy, because currently we're in an energy security crisis. We've set up, you know, the Department of Energy Security and Net Zero. And that just tells you where the priority is there. But if we look at, you know, specifically at carbon capture and storage, you know, we're talking about taking vast quantities of CO2, whether it's out of the atmosphere or whether it's from direct flue emissions, and putting it underground. We call it storage. By definition, you know, when you think of what storage is, you kind of imagine, you know, living in a big 4-bedroom house, moving to a smaller apartment, not being able to take some of your furniture with you and putting it into storage, with the view that when you move into a bigger property, you will take your furniture out. We've got no intentions of taking that CO2 out of the ground. So actually the term storage in itself, which, you know, government have been lobbied to name as storage, was and should be called landfill. And of course, as soon as you start using the term landfill, that's when you will get, you know, policies potentially changing away from storage. And then at the same time, we've got vast quantities of CO2. We've had for the last couple of years, we've had a shortage of CO2. Now, a big part of my job is educating people on what we can do with CO2, because it's most of the people that sit in this specialist field only think that you can put it under the ground and that's the best place it needs to be. But, you know, we use it for everything. We use it for manufacturing. We use it for soft drinks. A couple of years ago, we had a beer shortage. You know, the salads, your salads that you have, they stay fresh because of the CO2. You've got carbonated drinks. I mean, it's used in industry. And the idea is that we're still taking virgin fossil fuel out of the ground for CO2, to use that CO2 in a number of products. You know, if you look at surfactants go into almost every single household product, your cleaning products, your washing up liquid, your fairy liquids, your hand wash, your shampoos. So where is this all coming from? Rather than, you know, take out virgin fossil fuel to create this, why are we not capturing those CO2 emissions and using it back into industry? Because realistically, we've still got a very long time before we get to a point where we don't need virgin fossil fuel for products anymore. So I think who has the loudest voice here? Well, certainly when you look at that example and you say to yourself, well, why are we storing such large or talking about storing at cost? Because it doesn't generate revenue. So at cost, you know, potentially taxpayers' money to take this CO2 and store it underground if actually we can use it. You know, we can capture emissions off ships, create things like aggregates for construction and road material, which is road and building material, which is a form of storage. We can also, we're looking at, you know, technologies that can do DME, diesel, synthetic aviation fuel. And realistically, I mean, I can pretty much tell you that it will be a long time before we are sat in hydrogen fueled planes. So we all talk about the energy transition, but what we're not talking about is the actual transitional piece. And that's where we are. If you look at ships, for example, they are built to last 50 plus years. And they're not in a position, a lot of them are not in a position to switch to ammonia or hydrogen. So what are we doing in that transitional piece? Or are we just looking at the end goal? And sometimes I think when we're looking at that end goal, certainly when policy is concerned and where we're concerned with where the responsibility lies, if it's put on companies like the energy companies, yes, they are the ones that fund a lot of these technologies. But that transitional piece in the middle is key to getting us there. And that's what we're missing. And in order for us to do that, that's where the education, and particularly not just the collaboration, but what I like to call the co-creation. We need to come together and co-create.
Thank you. I'm going to ask my next question to Gaurav. Gaurav, I'm going to give you a magic wand here. And you can fix something. What are you going to fix first for the decarbonisation net zero journey on a global scale? What's the first domino to fall that's going to help have a knock-on effect on all of these other things? We've spoken about how connected a lot of these technologies are, and that sustainability is decarbonisation is actually more of an ecosystem. So, which one thing would you put your money on to start the momentum that we need?
Great question, Kate. You know, in general, if I had a magic wand, I'd give myself many wishes, not just one. But since I'm limited to one for now, I hate saying this as an engineer, but I think ending our global fragmentation around policy and our global fragmentation around the importance of climate change and its detriments, I think is really where I would start. Because what you need is you really need collective alignment or two things. Agreement that there is, without a doubt, you know, this is a big issue. But the second part is really agreeing that this has financial consequences that we need to support. I think being able to do that actually unlocks everything else. You know, there's reticence with technologists, there's reticence with finance, there's reticence with sort of customers, because you don't know where this is all going to go. And are you really going to end up in situations where, you know, different jurisdictions have different values placed to carbon abatement? If you eliminate this and there's a level playing field, I think technology will move rather quickly. Of course, you know, the next thing that this does, and you know, it's important that you sort of chose to sort of bracket me to just one thing. But what this fragmentation also ends is it will speed up regulatory actions and permitting that's necessary to move projects along. Because, you know, otherwise you have projects that are 10 years in a cycle where they're just getting permitted, which isn't helpful at all.
Interesting. Thank you very much. Natasha, same question to you. You got a magic wand. You can only fix one thing, can't ask for more wishes or more wands. What is it you're going to put your money on?
I think it's very similar and related to the way Gaurav was thinking about it. And it goes back to my point on we're not accounting for the future costs of the impact of what we're doing, right? And so if there was a way to make the cost of everything that we're doing with carbon equitable to the technologies that we need to innovate on, to be able to invest into, to be able to understand those risks, as Bina was saying, in order to be able to invest into them, scale them, actually use them, then I think, going back to my point on one of the biggest barriers, I think, is the fact that we still look at all of this from a very capitalistic approach. And if something doesn't make immediate money or it's too risky, we tend to steer away from it. Then that's what I would like to do, is use that magic wand to find a way of putting them on an equal playing field, as Corin was saying, and then letting market forces do what market forces do, because you will absolutely find that it'll head in the right direction. We're not able to cost out the future impact of what carbon is currently doing to our beautiful earth. And I think that is where the problem lies, in being able to really invest into the future technologies that we actually need to make this change.
I like that. It's a sort of recalibrating capitalism to start doing what it does best, right? You know, you were talking a little bit about that too. I'm going to hand the wand over to you. You don't have to do the same theme, but over to you.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I think certainly very recently, Professor Peter Starring of Sheffield University, he wrote a paper on custodians of carbon. And that pretty much sums it up for me. We need to become custodians of carbon. So we need to look after carbon like it's precious. And therefore that encourages us to, you know, reduce, reuse, repair, recycle, and just really create a circular carbon economy, where we're not actually taking any more CO2 out from or taking fossil carbon for new products and processes. So the idea is that we hold on to that CO2, we hold on to that carbon, and we reuse it as many times as we possibly can. If that mindset shift could change, then that, I think, is the one thing that I would change. It's the behavioral element, the psychology element of taking ownership of the CO2 that you, not only that you emit, but that you reuse, or, you know, the whole premise of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and putting it under the ground, making it somebody else's problem, or our planet's problem, I should say, is not really where we want to be. And it doesn't really encourage us to do the whole circular carbon economy thing. So that is the one thing. If everyone could take ownership and do what I call become custodians of carbon.
Thank you very much. Bina's going to hand her wand over to you, Stephen.
Yes, well, I think everybody has some incredibly valid points, you know, and if I come back to, let's say, the political view, I think my kind of take on really this magic wand is that if people had greater empathy with one another, that would be the main thing that would allow people to focus their minds on what is the real challenge that we're facing. The reason why we don't get regulations sort of passed at the highest levels is because people are living different lives, they have different experiences, and some people have positions that they don't necessarily want to relinquish. And I think if everybody had a greater sense of humility and empathy, then people would more appreciate the other people in their other shoes, to the point where things would actually kind of happen in a more seamless way, I think. Again, I think the main stumbling block is that we're not sort of allowing kind of viewpoints from different angles to all coexist. Even if we talk about, for example, technologies, I see the technology wars coming out, or it's electrification, no, it's hydrogen, oh no, you know, and it's not horses for course, you know, it's basically, you know, it's not one size fits all. It's there are many different solutions, and there's many ways of looking at this. People have different experiences. And I think if we just had a better, humility and understanding of each other, then we'd be able to get those policies, and we'd all be thinking on the same page, not necessarily coming from the same experience and viewpoint, but we would all be working towards that common goal with a greater understanding.
I like that. I think humility is always a great place to start, isn't it? I am, on that note, they're going to absolutely abuse my position as moderator, take my wand back and share that my wish would probably be to scale nuclear fusion as quickly as possible. However, lots of trepidation around infrastructure, the lack of policy there, global energy, geopolitics, all going to like be thrown into the mix. So a little bit crazy, which kind of leads us a little bit into our Q&A session. But again, abusing my position, and asking for sort of a quick fire response from panelists. What's your thoughts around a scaled up nuclear fusion? Sorry, if I said fission earlier, I meant fusion, scaled up nuclear fusion.
I guess my worry with that would be, and I definitely know not enough about this technology, but to your point on the geopolitics, I think that would be my biggest concern. So if we had Korov's wand that's then made, you know, globally everybody aligned, and then you threw nuclear fusion into the mix, then yeah, absolutely, I'm golden. But at the moment when everybody's not aligned, I think I'd really worry about the implications of what that kind of technology and I guess unlimited energy, which is basically what it is, could mean for us as a human race. So sorry, I come with a bit more trepidation than hope. Apologies.
I think I'd agree with Natasha actually, along the same sort of lines. It's a bit like this kind of, you know, the chat GPT of the sustainable tech world. It's kind of, there's no bounds. So that would certainly be worrying for me. So I'd agree with Natasha on that.
Okay, I'll spare you because it's a really difficult topic and perhaps quite an evil one for me. We've had a couple of questions though, all sort of coalescing around how do we avoid greenwashing and drive genuine sustainable practices in businesses? I'm going to point this one at Gaurav.
Thanks for asking, Kate. So, you know, I think one of the things that we're really missing in this business is standardized methods and measures of measurement. You know, when you've got a standardized basis, it's pretty easy to try and determine what the relative benefit, advantage, disadvantage, demerit might be. And so there really needs to be a focus on developing these standardized measures. I think, unfortunately, we are in a bit of a situation where, you know, I think national governments haven't really stepped up to say, you know, we're going to establish these baseline measures that are technology neutral. And you have every technology innovator running around saying, I'm better than everybody else. And, you know, I think that there's inherently a bit of an immaturity to it. But what that immaturity does is it does two things, both of which are problematic. First, it does not allow a clear basis of assessment because you muddy the waters. The second part, which I think is even worse, is I think it leads to false promise and false hope, both of which are really problematic. And so I think what is really needed is national governments, you know, just like we have air quality standards that are all the same, more or less all around the world, as one example, there's many others. You need the equivalent of a rating system where you can take any technology, you can sort of throw it into the mix, and there's an answer that comes out at the end as to whether it's really worthy or not. That's where you start.
Thank you. My next question, I'm going to point over at Natasha, kind of on the theme of electric vehicles, but really you could look at any of the sort of green technology required for the energy transition. So a lot of these technologies require a huge amount of extraction of raw materials, particularly things like rare earth elements, where the global south is really disadvantaged in this respect because they have a lot of these elements and China globally has a real dominance on processing them. So how is that being factored into scaling up technologies like electric vehicles from your perspective?
Yeah, no, and I'd argue that that's definitely the elephant in the room when it comes to when we talk about decarbonization of transport. So we talk about it being zero emission at point of use, and that's great, but it is definitely not looked at necessarily from well to wheel. And when it is looked at well to wheel, even then the carbon emissions are lower, but there's a whole bunch of other impacts that don't get talked about. So like Cora was saying, because you don't have a standardized measure of measuring everything, the result is that you can easily cover those aspects up almost to an extent and then kind of say that's not really a problem. How is it being addressed? So it is a problem, absolutely. How is it being addressed? Well, I think one bit that is being recognized is that obviously China does hold a lot of that processing power, and our current geopolitical climate means that everybody's looking at national security a little bit more carefully. The United States Inflation Reduction Act has had a huge impact on the overall value chain and supply chain of battery manufacturing, basically. So whether it comes to the mining of those particular minerals, but also in the actual processing and development of those, there's been, I think, over $1 billion to $2 billion of investment commitment to say that supply chain and value chain is going to be developed in the US. That still makes it very polarized. It's still very much north and south, not denying that. But that's one thing that has changed the dynamics of where some of this stuff sits. The second really encouraging thing actually is that it's been widely recognized for a little while that cobalt is probably arguably one of the biggest sort of rare earth minerals here that has particularly devastating environmental impacts and humanitarian impacts. Cobalt is typically mined in the Congo, and the way it's mined is not good for anybody. And I think the result of that is that every single battery technology kind of chemistry is trying to eliminate the use of cobalt. So a Tesla Model 3 has no cobalt in it. And that's been one of the first. So you're looking at lithium iron phosphate and other sort of ways of making sure that at least cobalt is minimized. We need to find another more sustainable way of thinking about the overall amounts of lithium required. And then further, there's technology there thinking about sodium ion batteries. Sodium, of course, is a lot more widely available, wouldn't have the same implications as lithium would. So comes back to innovation and scale, but I think it's fair to say that we haven't solved the problem, but it is recognized. And there have been some steps to address it, but not arguably at the scale that we probably need to be working on it.
Thank you. Stephen, one for you. Do you think the hydrogen industry needs to be a bit more open about its limitations and step back where more effective technologies exist?
I think it depends on who you're speaking with. You know, I can only speak from my own point of view. And here at Unitrove, while yes, we are focusing on hydrogen technologies as a kind of a core focus of what we're doing, it's not like the be all and end all. And in fact, we're actually open to all different types of solutions. I'm not about finding a particular technology that's going to fit the agenda. You know, for me, it's about what is the right solution, what is the actual problem, and what is the right or the ideal solution for that specific case. So, you know, we're not about going, oh, well, you know, hydrogen works and fits with everything. And I'm open and honest about that. So in my opinion, for example, I don't feel that hydrogen is a suitable option for cars. You know, I personally believe that EVs and electric vehicles is probably going to be the likely dominant solution that will be transcended worldwide. And certainly, you know, I probably wouldn't have it any other way, because there are so many great things about electrification, certainly from the efficiency side of things. You know, I know that hydrogen has often been pointed at as being a very inefficient way of directing energy to different places, which is true, you know. Maybe there will be some organizations that might not talk openly about that, but I'm certainly open about these kind of things. And it's necessary, because at the end of the day, you know, again, it comes back to what Bina was talking about in terms of education. The more that we can kind of educate people in terms of what are the real true options out there, the more likely we're going to come up with solutions, and more likely that it's going to solve the issues that we really need solving. So, you know, definitely I'm kind of personally technology agnostic. Certainly, you know, there are only certain reasons why I'm focusing on hydrogen, because we're focusing on certain niches that we feel that there are certain interesting applications that it's quite well suited to. But we're also recognizing those limitations as well. But I think people need to have a bit of a wider view in terms of what is the real thing that's actually, you know, we're looking to try and solve. And I think some people go, I think somebody's solution is not somebody else's solution, because they're looking to solve two different things, if you see what I mean. And I think one of the other things I just wanted to kind of mention as well is that I think Natasha was kind of pointing out to this idea of, you know, sometimes I think we're actually looking at sustainability too narrowly. Personally, I kind of look to sustainability and guidance from the UN Sustainable Development Goals, where we're not just focusing on, you know, clean and affordable energy for all, which is just one of these SDGs, as they call them, the Sustainable Development Goals, but everything else in its entirety. So, you know, there was a touching base on sort of the social conditions of mining of rare earth metals. You know, we can't be sort of, you know, having all these nice electric cars, which will maybe be decarbonizing in certain locations, in certain regions, for maybe certain people with certain wealth, and then also impacting people in a negative way, you know, for those means. You know, these things have to be happening concurrently. Even sort of discussions like DEI, you know, it's quite interesting where we're seeing, you know, some people going, yeah, we're going to be creating these new clean solutions, but it's coming from the old traditional ways of doing things, and the same kind of traditional groups of people that will be looking to push these kind of technologies. So in some ways, we're not actually really solving these things. So there's many aspects I think that we have to consider there.
Gosh, I couldn't agree more that we need to really think about a bigger picture. Sustainable for what? Do we just want to be sort of, we need to be living in a functional world at the end of this, right? Once we've achieved net zero. So I can absolutely see about seeing things in context of a bigger picture, which also speaks to your earlier point there about hydrogen. People asking questions about hydrogen or asking more focused and directed questions need to probably understand the context of how it's going to be used for storage versus fuel and all of these different things. So I totally agree. Thank you very much. I would like to ask my next question. I'm going to go around in a second, but my next one to Bina, can we transition in time? Are we on track?
I think that's honestly, if I had a crystal ball, I'd be able to answer that one. It depends on what we mean by when is the right time, because those goalposts are changed almost on a daily, weekly basis. So, you know, at one point we're told that, right, it has to be 1.5, or we're not going to reach 1.5. So we need to, you know, do something else. Are we going to reach it in time? I think I like to be hopeful that we will. And I think, again, with the collaboration within across industry, along with government, I think it's certainly possible. And I do think that us understanding that we are particularly taking ownership of this for each and every one of us, not just as organizations, but as individuals, is going to be key to getting there. I don't think we're quite there with regards to ownership. I know somebody asked a question around sort of carbon colonialism. That's a huge question and a huge answer. And certainly when we're looking at things like offsets, for example, you know, there is a certain element of, well, you know, we can continue doing what we're doing as long as we can go away and buy trees somewhere that hopefully won't burn down. So this is kind of the problem that we've got, is it needs to be driven from government. It needs to be driven by policy and regulation. And at the moment, we don't have that in place. Certainly when we look at the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, and we do the comparison to see what we've got here, we don't have that here. So that collaboration piece isn't happening. And we're not just talking about, you know, cross industry, but we're talking globally. Everybody's got different targets to get to net zero, some 2050, some 2045 in Scotland, you know, 2070 in other parts of the world. Why are we not? Will we get there? Hopefully, yes. But the only way that we will get there is if we work together on this. And that is something that we're not doing at the moment.
Thank you. Gaurav, I have a question directly for you. As a professor, how do you see the next generation of innovators developing?
It's a great question. You know, I think in many ways, so there's the pros and the cons, right? So I think let's focus on the pros for a second. I'll come back to the cons. I think if we look at the pros, I think this is a time at which, you know, I think societally we're very focused on a goal that we think we want to accomplish. I think this is good. Because if we sort of look at, you know, the next 100 years before us, this is my view of the world, but I think there are two fundamental aspects that will shape the next century. One is the extension of human life. The other one is really climate change. I think between this, you've got sort of a nice societal call to action. And what that does is it focuses people's time, attention, and energy towards a goal. I think there is a need simultaneously, you know, to be able to realize that this is a point at which we're going to see the creation of technologies and potentially companies that are going to define the next 100 years as well. And so you've got strong motivators. I think the con that's associated with this is that these things just take time. And you know, this is not to say that we should give up our ambition, a sense of purpose, but in general, the earlier you are in your career, you know, you've got the opportunity to train yourself to be able to work in these areas. And I think if you can access that training well enough, well, you're off to the races. And so I think really sort of mission orientation and the ability for flexible training, I think these are the two things we need to focus on.
Thank you very much. We've got a tiny bit of time left, so I'm going to go to Stephen with the question that I asked Bina earlier. In a sentence, can we transition in time?
Yes, we can.
I like it. Nice and succinct. Hopeful. Natasha, over to you.
A news article recently kind of scared the bejesus out of me. It said that we are going to be hitting 1.5 degrees, but not stay there. And I don't, it goes back to a little bit on what we've all been talking about around the education piece, or just calling a spade a spade. So I can understand we may not be trying to alarm people, but at the same time, we're going to be hitting 1.5 degrees. And I don't see why they had to add the but we're not going to stay there. Why don't we just realize the scale of the problem here? And so I don't think we're moving quickly enough, and that I really love to be hopeful, like Steve and Bina, but we've got so much to do.
Can I just very quickly also say that the language that we use, particularly in the media, doesn't help.
No.
And when we say, you know, for each 1 degree of temperature rise, it displaces something like 1 billion people. If we were to use that language a bit better, you know, when you look at sort of the floods in Pakistan, et cetera, then that would make the impact, we're not going to reach, or we're going to do X, Y, Z in degrees. It just doesn't work for the general population. So that was just what I wanted to add on to Natasha's comment there.
For sure. The media play an enormous role in our collective and individual action towards climate change. And I think my personal opinion is they could probably be a little bit more on board with bringing it to, you know, helping people visualize what it's going to mean to them at an individual level. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're out of time, everybody. So thank you so much, Bina, Stephen, Natasha and Gaurav. Thanks for having me moderate you. Over back to Ollie.
Thanks so much, Kate. What a fantastic conversation. Really important. You know, I was making notes myself throughout the importance of collective alignment, having the issues around standards and how we sort of measure and the methods of measuring and alignment around that. That led on to responsibility. Where does responsibility lie? You know, governmental level, corporate level, individual level. And the notion of the custodians of carbon. You know, I really think that's a. You know, we can't afford to kick the can down the road to some other generation to think about what to do with that. It's our responsibility now. Unfortunately, the time is ticking, and I've heard time and time again that solutions take time, and time is kind of not on our side here. So. The final kind of note that I made was around education, and I think in this webinar we've done a small part within that piece of the jigsaw. The richness of this discussion will kind of be maintained for some time. So thank you so much to Bina, to Stephen, to Natasha, to Gaurav, and of course to Kate for leading the conversation, and thank you to everyone for listening in. This is the first part of a series, so please do look out for our next conversations as part of this series with Mars Wrigley UK. Thank you, everyone, and good night.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Aspen UK podcast. Our thanks to Hayden Taylor, who edited this episode. If you'd like to listen to more of our conversations, you can find all our past editions on our website, which is www.aspenuk.org, or obviously wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to stay up to date with all things Aspen UK, why not subscribe to our newsletter? You'll receive regular updates in your inbox about our live events, our leadership seminars, our fellowships, and so much more. You can register at our website, which again is www.aspenuk.org.